Center for Life Writing, which is based at Wolfson College. Her most recent publications are Postcolonial Poetics, 21st Century Readings, and the short story collection To the Volcano, which we will be talking about today. She's a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and a fellow of Royal Historical Society. Some of her other books include Colonial and Postcolonial Literature, Empire, the National and the Postcolonial, and the prize-winning novel, The Shouting in the Dark. To the Volcano was highly recommended by for the Australian Review of Books, Elizabeth Jolie Award in 2019. Andrew Brink has described Professor Burma as a writer who, and I quote him, brings to her stories two qualities that all too often are mutually exclusive: the lucidity of her intelligence and the passion of her engagement, unquote. So please join me in welcoming our guest for the first in this series this year. The format today is as follows. Our guest would do a short reading, which would then be followed by a conversation, and then we'll invite questions from the audience. You can either click the icon to raise your hand, or you actually do so by, you know, just raising your hand so I can see you. Or you can type your questions and send it. I will be monitoring that. If at any point, you know, during the process of question and answer, I'm not able to see your question, the others who are monitoring, so they will allow me to, so I'll be able to ask you raise your question, or to, you know, raise your question, or either to read out your questions that you have typed out. So join me in welcoming Professor Burma to this first in seminar series. Welcome.
Hi, Wale. There's a bit of echo on the line. It's gone. Excellent. Hi again. Thanks so very much to you, Wale, for hosting me to talk about To the Volcano. Also to your colleagues, in particular David Pratton, for setting this up, and also to the African Studies Center. I wish we were there now, physically in real time. It's a place I'm so fond of and feel very at home at, but sadly we are in this medium. But in a way, thank goodness, because we can still talk and read books together. This is a bit of a voyage of discovery for me. I've not done a reading on Teams or Zoom or anything like this before. So, if I run over or say too much, just stop me. Hello to everyone out there. I'm sorry I can't see you all. I'm really looking forward to this discussion, both with Wale and with everyone else. Just before I begin the short reading, we thought it might be a fun thing to do. I have a free copy of the book to give away to anyone who's interested in having it, and to secure the book, all you need to do is to be the first person to send me an email with the correct answer to the following question. It's a question relating to one of the stories in To the Volcano. And the question is this: who is John's true love? I won't give the story away. There's only one character, John, in the stories. Who is John's true love? And there's my email. So the first correct answer to the question, I'll repeat it again later on, will receive the book from me. Okay, great. So what I'm going to do for this opening reading is to read from the very first story in the collection. I've chosen it for a reason that I think people will very quickly cotton onto. I won't give it away. other than to say that the story is set in an old university town somewhere in England. The story is called The Child in the Photograph. I will read for about 7 minutes, and then I unfortunately won't be able to read the whole story in 7 minutes, but I'll read for 7 minutes, and then I'll just kind of stop and invite you to finish reading it in your own time. The Child in the Photograph. From Africa is how they introduce me, Luanda tells her mother on her first trunk call home. Isn't it funny, Ma? Just from Africa. Can you believe? A crackle zaps her mother's reply. After the Angolan port city, Luanda tells her fellow master's students in development. Yes, that's my name. But Angola's not my country. See if you can guess my country. For starters, it's landlocked and dry and farther south than the Sahara. Getting warmer, Luanda laughs. My country also has diamonds. That's a dead giveaway. What you call yourselves, development students? My country has loads of diamonds. You tell them, her mother says down a suddenly clear phone line. Your country's brightest diamond, easily, brighter than any star. Luanda shuts her eyes. Her mother's voice is as close as if she were right here beside her in the college phone booth. She pictures her there in the living room at home, her big thighs spread across the fake leather easy chair beside the TV. She sees the black plastic mouthpiece wedged between her cheek and her shoulder in that clever way of hers, like the PA she is. She sees her red painted fingernails twisting around the black telephone cord. On the wall across from her mother are her own framed certificates. Luanda pictures them clearly, the certificates arranged on the wall in two columns, her university medals and honors and essay prizes, the rungs of the long ladder she has climbed to get to this ancient stone college with its single shabby telephone booth and muddy McDonald's wrappings thick on the floor. She sees the gold embossed lettering on the certificates catch the horizontal light of the setting sun. Nothing short of a fancy sundial, her mother's boyfriend Pa once mock scolded. Look, the letters even cast a shadow. Proud of her mother staunchly said. A pink and white hand beats against the glass of the phone booth door. The glass is cloudy with condensation. Luanda can't see the body behind the hand. Can hardly believe it being here, she yells over another squall of static on the line. The other students can't believe it either. I mean, me being here. When I walk into a room, they stop talking. They all stare. So, you're educating them. No matter how ancient and clever, they have something to learn. Luanda laughs at her mother's joke, if it was a joke. She laughs the open-mouthed laugh that she shares with her mother. Ha, 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 it goes, rasping to a close. Some days, even Nana can't tell their laughs apart. I must go, Ma. Next time, Nana will come say hello. Sorry, Lou. She was here, but she's run off. The swallow Luanda now makes hurts her chest. The hand again slaps the door. Her mother is calling, bye, bye, over and over again. Bye, Luanda echoes her, bye. Then she presses the silver next call button and her mother's voice cuts out. She stands holding the receiver in her hand, the dial tone purring. She rubs the condensation on the glass with her sleeve. Whoever was out there has given up. The foyer is empty. She scrapes off the McDonald's wrapping sticking to her shoe and takes the stairs up to her room two at a time, breathing hard with relief, almost laughing, as if she has escaped something, has got through an obstacle course without injury. Luanda relies on her laugh in the days ahead, At the 100 icebreaker parties and inductions, she lists in beautiful schoolgirl cursive in her diary. She laughs and watches her laugh's effect on people, how it makes them turn towards her and smile. Laughing, she slides across thickly carpeted rooms between shuffling clusters of guests, like a rain droplet down a windscreen. Laughing when they stumble on her name, laughing when they ask about her course and then forget and ask again, laughing, laughing, till the other students start calling her Laughing Luanda. Laughing, she asks them to stop. She wanders around the old university town, her university town, believe it or not, but now she doesn't laugh. A dream is beyond laughter, and all this is beyond a dream. It's beyond her imagination. Not in a thousand years could she have dreamed up this perfect green grass in the quadrangles, or the spreading trees like pictures, or the all-surrounding stone, the stone walls, stone flags, the Gothic stone arch of her bedroom window looking like it was stamped out with a cookie cutter, the stone steps up to her room worn away by the numberless footsteps of numberless students. I mean, stone, Ma, cut stone, worn stone, like it's melting, she said on the phone and still couldn't quite believe it. She could not have dreamed up the pure coldness that rises from the stone and instantly chills her hand when she touches it, that anything could be so cold. She could not have imagined the cold, dark shadows that wait in the corner of the stone and never shift. Even at noon, they don't shrink away. Her university before this one, where she received the trophies and certificates on her mother's wall, is no more than a cluster of single-story prefab blocks built on the surrounding red sand. On the side of each building, a single huge air conditioning unit sticks out like an ear stud. The dusty area in front of the admin buildings is called the English Garden, though the only plants that grow there are cactuses. The English Garden. Looking around at the green grass, the spreading oaks, Luanda wants to laugh, remembering, but catches herself in time and feels ashamed. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leke. First, let me see how much I enjoyed reading this book, and so I'm very happy that we are having a conversation about it. Almost in every single story in the book, we encounter characters who are struggling with as well as against the curse and what might call the curse of life, both in its everydayness and also in the long term. So in writing these stories, I'm wondering what were your overarching reflections about the narratives. Were you thinking about the implications of the everyday for the larger structural challenges of human life or the obverse?
Oh, thank you for the question, Wale. I mean, it's a huge question and we could take it in different ways. If I look back across this collection, I mean, it might be helpful for people who don't know it to say that there are there are 12 stories, 12 stories in the collection, and you know, 12 suggested to me it was a good number. It suggested to me you know, a year, 12 months in a year. It suggested a kind of arc, an arc of time. You know, and in fact, the stories do more or less, I mean, there isn't a rigid pattern to this, but they do more or less lead us from stories of young people, youth, also children, as in the child in the photograph, running through middle age to old age. Those two stories are quite preoccupied with questions of legacy and end of life, I suppose. They're quite quiet stories, whereas there's a sort of there's a liveliness at the start. So it was interesting to me to explore, I suppose, through the different characters in the 12 stories, the dimensions of an individual life, of people who, apart from the character in the final story, the biographer and the wife, of people who are not kind of living in any kind of limelight or in any kind of flashpoint of history. In fact, on the contrary, they're coming in from the edges of the continental masses in some cases, the provinces, if you like, of the world. So I was interested also, I think, in putting the accent there on life, I was interested also to think about, you're talking about the course and the curse of life there. And that relates absolutely to something that I was trying to do with, exploring how life isn't really set up for us human beings. this is something I was reflecting on when Louise Gluck won the Nobel Prize for Literature last week, because her poetry is so, powerfully and painfully about this thing too, that often with all our hopes and dreams, our conditions, our setup, of in our individual life, it doesn't always lead to the fulfillment of those dreams. It often takes, a lot of pain and sacrifice before we get there. And that's what I think you see in the case of a number of the characters in these stories. They are, and the short story is a great medium for really homing in, really bearing down on some of these questions as they relate to individual lives. People in quest of love, in quest of a certain ambition, in quest of family, what it takes to get to that point. So definitely course and also curse of life. Yeah.
Thank you. So in the title and the photograph which you just read to us now, it seems to me that this is a story about the struggle with home as a concrete manifestation of relationships, obligations, and belongingness, including, of course, the attendant tensions regarding how one reconciles oneself with movement and stasis in relation to nature, relationships, obligations, and responsibilities. So in the light of these, I was wondering about Luanda's chosen postgraduate course, which is developing. It appeared to me to be a metaphor that raises questions about how to reconcile movement and stasis in relation to natural obligations and cosmopolitan opportunities and vistas. So do you think this is a plausible way to read this story, The Child in the Photograph?
I should probably say first of all, in response, Wale, that every reader's response is a valid response. I very much believe that the writer works together with the reader to get at the meaning of a story. And often the reader can find meanings that the writer may not, at least consciously, have thought of. To pick up on some of the key words in what you just asked, home and away, this question of development, and this question of belonging. Development is such a loaded word, as I'm sure everyone listening can relate to. The division of the world into developed and undeveloped, developing countries. The implication always is developed as against undeveloped, but the polite PC word is developing. The question that we always want to ask then is, by whose criteria developed? Who sets the standards? And development always seems to imply a kind of slope of progression, which in the case of the character in the story, the central character, Luenda, becomes, extremely complicated. Her development studies program requires her to, if you like, halt her life development, you know, put a pause to her life development, her development as an individual in a family, her relationships with the rest of her family, because she has to travel so very far away and make so very many compromises and sacrifices in order to take her degree, you know, to study towards that degree in development. So her experience also asks questions of, what is a developed land, as in, the earth, what are the raw materials that need to be extracted for development to take place? And I think most of all, what is lost in the process? Development is always judged really by capitalist criteria of onwards and upwards, and farther and better. So the story asks the questions, then what, and what is lost in the process? What of our humanness lost in that process?
Yeah, when I was reading the book, I kept thinking about Milan Kundera, especially The Unbearable Lightness of Being. So the paradox is that while many of the characters reflect what you might call the lightness of being, that is the non-recurring nature of each individual life, the obverse is also at the background of most of these lives. That is what has been described as the heaviness of life and the consequences, of course, of macro decisions at the level of the state and society for our individual lives, such as apartheid, for instance, state collapse, war, and all of that. So my question is this perhaps what you had in mind, particularly in Evelina, when she says that if she didn't fly away, and I quote her, the extremities of the earth would swallow her up. I think my thing when I was reading it, I was thinking about the fact that she's reflecting that despite the lightness that we oftentimes have to contend with, that the heaviness is what actually overdetermines our lives.
Yes, I mean, I'm very flattered that you were thinking of Milan Kundera through these readings, and certainly structurally, in terms of the narration, in these short stories, lightness is really what I wanted to achieve. I wanted the stories to, as it were, end lightly into the reader's kind of consciousness, mindset, so that they come across as, stories, as a tale told, but then they lightly begin to ask some questions that then, the more we think about them, bear down quite heavily. So the story South North that you mention, which is from my memory, yes, that's right, it's the second story. It's very, in some ways it follows a similar trajectory to the child in the photograph. It's about a young woman who travels from, as you were saying, the extremities of the earth, from very, very far away, to come to what we would call the center or the metropolis, or indeed the developed world, in order to pursue a dream or to pursue an ambition. And in that process begins to encounter, if you like, the heaviness of history, the heaviness of, a history often of violence or war or of possessiveness that has been contested, often around the kind of the places of greatest concentration, so the metropolis of the planet. So, lightness of touch, and then, if you like, heaviness of the blowback from these stories. You know, the heaviness of the kinds of questions that I hope they ask of the reader in.
I actually think that this your greatest achievement in this book is the way in which you deal with heaviness through lightness, so which was why I was interested in that, because even in the most banal of circumstances, you know, we see many characters, you know, reflecting what Yeats describes as passionate intensity, which he says results from, you know, a certain kind of uncertainty. And, you know, I see that a lot in the character. So I'm wondering, is your subject more about general philosophical uncertainty in life, or the specific, you know, empirical precarity that is reflected in some of the characters? So are you concerned about the general philosophical questions, or more about the, you know, specific, you know, precarity that people have to face as reflected in some of these characters? And I'm asking this because, you know, you're also a critic and professor, you know, so I'm wondering whether what was, you know, most striking as you were composing this in your mind, are these the questions that you as a scholar would be concerned with, or the question, you know, the more empirical questions that you think that are reflected in through the characters?
I suppose, there's a bit of echo again.
No, we can hear you very well.
Okay, good. So, it's both. Well, if I'm, you know, dead honest and give a kind of, you know, very straightforward answer that I will then kind of, you know, unpack a bit. It's both. With the important proviso, I think that when I go into you know, my lair, my eyrie, to write stories, I leave my other professional roles at the door. You mean, in other words, I can't bring the philosophical questions in with me into that space, if you like, because I think that would simply compromise the process of storytelling, of putting the stories together. I do think though that every writer has an ethical mission. You know, we wouldn't write if we didn't. And yes, I am incredibly preoccupied as a writer, as a human being, by precarity, by the precarity of you know, the huge majority of individual lives on this planet, and of, you know, our lives in community too, which of course this crisis that we're all in now, the corona crisis, kind of brings powerfully to mind. So each life, I think, or you know, some of the stories are to do with, you know, a group of people or a pair of people, or a pair of individuals, characters. Every character in to a greater or lesser extent is confronting questions of fragility, vulnerability, and precarity on this planet and in society. So that, I suppose, if I step back, is something that I'm preoccupied by, that I keep coming back to. Yeah, definitely. But the bigger philosophical questions are, you know, I won't say that they're not in my mind at some level in the process of writing. Inevitably they are. And I'm always very pleased when later I come back to a story, when I've finished writing a story, and I've edited to a point where I'm more or less satisfied with its shape, I then tend to put it to one side, and then later when I come back to it to see how it fits, you know, where it might, where I might place it in the mosaic of a collection, it's then that I encounter with a greater or lesser degree of interest and satisfaction, whether it speaks to, if you like, my ethical concerns, you know, and I'm always very pleased when it does. I mean, some of the stories don't at all. There's a story about somebody suffering from dementia, which, you know, still quite, you know, moves me and makes me quite tearful sometimes when I reread it. Now, I wouldn't say that has a particular, philosophical question to ask, but it does bring the reader into a situation of empathy, I hope, with the characters, the an old woman and her grandson. So and that empathy is, I suppose, part of my ethical mission. Yeah.
Yeah, I want us to move on, but I'm wondering whether it is absolutely possible to leave the professor behind when you enter the mode of writing. That's another question. I imagine that the Global South is the geographical, if not also the epistemological center of all of these stories, especially to some extent in relation to the Global North. So I'm wondering why you think the South is critical for our understanding of the world, especially at this moment.
Thanks for the question. Yeah, it's a question very close to my heart. You're absolutely spot on. Most of the stories, the majority of the stories, are visibly or audibly set in some part of the Southern Hemisphere. Botswana, Zimbabwe, Australia, Argentina, South Africa, amongst others. So they are, taken together, reflections on what I call Southness, which in part means to me the Global South. So those who are at the non-beneficial end of the unequal planet that we are all a part of. But the South also signifies, in addition to or alongside Global South, it signifies something you already quoted, you know, the far extremities of the Earth. Those parts of the planet that have always been seen by the North, or by the West, or by the developed world, or those difficult terms, as infinitely exploitable, and the people there as infinitely exploitable. And so that, I hope, lightly, radiantly, is something that I do explore. I do kind of excavate and worry at and in these stories, you know, what it means to come from there, what it means to defend those spaces, to protect those spaces, and how those spaces also become, and we in the North, located in the North, ignore this at our peril, how those spaces are also a kind of barometer of, you know, the disaster that is awaiting this planet if we don't do something about the path we're on.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
One of the good things about this book is also how it makes us laugh. And I'm particularly in love with Iris, you know, refusing to wash the bed sheets for Paddy and John. Initially, I thought this was a categorical imperative, so to speak, that was a strongly held, conviction. towards a certain phenomenon that, you know, people should wash their own patients. But as it turned out, you know, it is a mere indication of purpose. So in writing about this, did you think of her refusal as a serious element in the context, or was it just a light touch to let us into what I would call amorous imperative, rather than the categorical imperative?
Well, both really. Thanks for the naughty question. Iris is standing upon her dignity. And she also has a certain, a kind of bone to pick, a political bone to pick, a sexual bone to pick with both John and Patty.
Yeah.
So, she makes a statement, about her own boundaries by refusing to wash the sheets. You know, they then pile up and lead to a minor crisis.
Well, it turns out it was also a way of negotiating. But anyway, you have been quite productive in both your creative and your scholarly life. In addition to, of course, holding academic administration positions. I'm wondering if you have advice for young scholar writers on how to combine these two exceedingly demanding worlds and still achieve success in both.
Well, thanks for the nice comment, Wale. Gosh, it's a big question. We could be all afternoon, really. And I'm aware that some people may be tuning in who've only just started on their, academic pathway, or maybe who've only just started on their writing pathway. I must mind what I say. I think it's, when I was younger, I would have given a different answer, I think, to this question. I might have said that the one kind of writing, so the creative writing, was rather different from the other kind of writing, the critical writing, and that the two came from different parts of, my life or my head. But I no longer think so. I think there's been a kind of convergence, and I hope this is helpful for people, in how I understand this practice of writing. When we're doing our critical writing, when we're talking about literature critically, or when we're writing history, writing about empire and colonial literature, we are nonetheless doing writing. And writing is a process of thinking in which we use the page and our hands and our bodies. It's a process of embodied thinking. It's supremely worthwhile. Whatever mode is particularly suited to you or you find particularly congenial. Both modes, or the modes combined, creative, critical, creative, philosophical, historical, they all require a kind of attunement to context and an attunement to the now. You know, when you're writing this word now or speaking it now, you're absolutely in the moment of your life, and that is, that is what I love about writing. I mean, sometimes you then take a step back, especially in critical writing, and reflect again on what you've just written down. But they are essentially similar processes of self-reflection and of attunement to the now. On running these two different kinds of writing alongside each other, it's tough. It requires quite a lot of self-discipline, you know, and I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say there've been moments of great frustration when I felt that maybe the one kind of writing has blocked the other, or you know, there's never enough time. as I think many people would agree. And of course, time for writing also demands time for not writing when you replenish, you know, when you replenish your senses so that you can write again.
Thank you. Yeah, let's open it up now. So please, if you have questions, can you raise either your digital